so much for joining us this rainy, rainy Monday. I am Kat Matsuda with the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, and I just wanted to say a quick welcome and thanks again for coming, and I will hand it off to our esteemed panel. Adam?
Hey, everyone. I just want to welcome everyone to this discussion on actualizing the National Broadband Plan. My name is Adam Bender. I'm a reporter with Communications Daily. I cover Capitol Hill. And I also did a fair amount of coverage on the workshops for the Broadband Plan, of which there were many. I just wanted to talk real quickly about why we have a Broadband Plan at all. In the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, Congress directed the FCC to develop a plan to bring broadband to parts of the country that are unserved, such as rural areas, and also to think about ways to improve adoption among people that have access to broadband, but for whatever reason, chosen not to subscribe. So the FCC delivered a plan on March 17th. The document is 376 pages long, so we're not going to read it to you. But it includes a number of proposals related to government subsidies, wireless airwaves, public safety, and a variety of other issues. And you can read the whole thing at broadband.gov if you want to do that. The plan's top goal is to bring affordable broadband with download speeds of 100 megabits per second and upload speeds of 50 megabits per second to 100 million homes by 2020. So the idea of this panel is basically just to outline what steps Congress and the FCC are going to need to take over the next weeks, months, and years to actually make the plan a reality. And I'm going to ask a series of questions, and then we're going to have about 15, 20 minutes of audience Q&A at the end, and we'll stop by 1:30. We want to keep this casual, so if anybody here on the panel uses some weird telecom jargon or acronym of which you don't know, feel free to interrupt. I'm just going to introduce the panelists. Closest to me, Michael Calabrese. He's director of the Wireless Future Program at the New America Foundation. Next to him is Rick Zimmerman, senior director of state telecom policy for NCTA, which is the association that represents cable. Next to him is Barbara Esmond. She's director of the Center for Communications and Competition Policy at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. And she worked at the FCC for more than 14 years. That's right. And finally, we have Derek Turner, who's the research director for Free Press. To start off, in a hearing Thursday, House Commerce Committee Chairman Henry Waxman praised the plan, but he said the real test is going to be the plan's implementation. So with that in mind, I just want the panelists to give a brief overview of big keys to turning this plan into action. Start with Michael.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Adam. Great to be here with the hordes of tourists at the Capitol Visitor Center. I think it's perhaps often overlooked simply how important it is to have a national broadband plan, since we haven't had one for the past decade, as much of the world, certainly our leading industrialized competitors, have been passing us by in terms of speed and affordability and even in some cases adoption. So that's going to be perhaps as important as the plan itself. I would highlight, I guess, since I'm going first, three very critical deployment goals in the plan that you'd really want to focus on. Of course, it's sometimes called the 100 squared because the plan calls for by 2020 that 100 million. Households should have at least 100 megabits per second download, 50 up. And what's key there, though, I think, is that it uses the word actual, so 150 actual speed, not just advertised. because the plan notes that the actual is about half of what's advertised typically, and also that it be affordable. And the plan goes into certain things like universal service reform for that purpose. Second is it calls for at least 1 gigabit per second of connectivity into every community for the public community anchor institutions, hopefully every school, library, hospital, to have a super fast connection, and which would really amplify the social benefits of those institutions. And then third is to lead the world in wireless. So it says the United States should lead the world in mobile innovation with the fastest and most extensive wireless networks of any nation. And I think this emphasis on wireless and on more spectrum access, including both flexibly licensed spectrum and more shared and unlicensed spectrum, is really spot on. The next competitive landmark and big boost for both business and personal productivity is pervasive connectivity. And we won't be able to be seamlessly connected to high capacity applications 24/7 without a huge increase in spectrum access and efficiency. And I'd mention, I guess, one more thing, which is, while that's overall a kind of a bright side, on the downside, I'm afraid the plan, and this is particularly on the wired side, that the plan may not be ambitious enough. For nearly a decade, as I mentioned, the U.S. has been falling behind on speed, affordability, and adoption. And the 100 squared goal, although it sounds ambitious, I mean, it is very ambitious compared to where the U.S. is today. There's two problems. First, by 2020, this goal is likely to leave the U.S. as far behind the leading IT nations as we are today. Many of our major competitors either already have universal service at 2 megabits per second or more, or plan to have it within 3 years, not 10 years, by 2020. But these same countries plan to have 50 to 100 megabits per second to 90 to 99% by 2015, not by 2020, and also, as I said, to 90 or 99% of their population, not to just 80%, as our plan calls for. Second, the plan seems to accept that 20% or more of our population will not have high-capacity applications that are described very well, in fact, in the national purposes section of the plan as so critical for health, education, and economic opportunity. So I think achieving universal high-capacity coverage is going to require something the plan was maybe a little bit politically timid to recommend, which was much more public investment, not just redirecting universal service money over a 10-year period, but actually getting new public investment in fiber networks to community anchor institutions, as well as public investment in open access middle mile fiber out to all the areas that would comprise that 20% that will be woefully left behind if by 2020 we only have 4 megabits per second.
Okay, Rick, do you agree that the plan is not ambitious enough?
Let me start out. I think it's ambitious in some areas, perhaps not in others. But you did note, Adam, at the outset that you weren't going to read the plan to the audience, and frankly, I haven't read the whole thing. But in keeping with recent events on the Hill, or at least recent suggestions on the Hill, I have deemed it read. So there's been a lot of press talk statements and all of that about the plan. I have not heard anyone quote or paraphrase Vice President Biden and say this is a great effing plan, but I think there is a lot to be said for it. Let me just say for a moment something about the cable industry that I know we have a mix of folks in the audience, both industry folks, congressional staffers, some that may be very steeped in the arcana and minutia of telecom policy, and others perhaps not so much. And certainly for the young staffers, may not know the history of broadband, at least let's say back to 1996 and the Telecommunications Act of 1996. But the fact is that the cable industry essentially invented mass market residential broadband in the U.S. I'm not going to get into all of that history. Happy to discuss that with others. But since the 96 Act, we have invested about $150 billion to make high-speed internet access available to 92% of the country. One of the things that the plan does do a good job of is articulating or recognizing kind of where things stand today. They commissioned a study from CITI, the Columbia Institute for Teleinformation at Columbia University, that looked at both where do we stand on broadband today, and just based on public announcements, no secret information from companies, but just public announcements they've made, where will we be in about 5 years. So cable makes high-speed internet access available today to 92% of the country. Speeds are getting faster and faster. We're rolling out something known as DOCSIS 3.0. DOCSIS is the Data Over Cable System Interface Specification, which, you know, is not something anyone really needs to know, but it's the standard by which cable modem service is made available. And in many markets today, it's available at a 50 megabit downstream advertised speeds. I want to come back to the actual versus advertised and what the plan gets wrong about those differences. But today, in many markets, a 50 megabit downstream is available. In some, it's 100 megabit. In many other places, in the next few years, cable companies will be making 100 megabit downstream service available. Probably to, I think it says, 85% of the country within a few years, according to the plan. So a couple of things that the plan gets right from our perspective. Certainly, pole attachments, something that you probably don't hear a lot about, but are very important with respect to infrastructure, both for cable and telephone companies in providing our services, as well as access to rights-of-way, ducts and conduits. The ability to extend our infrastructure. Now, I guess I would just put that in a category with respect to infrastructure of removing barriers to deployment, and I think that's one of the things that the plan does a good job of articulating what some of those barriers are and how some of those barriers might be removed. I think that something else that the plan that I personally like about the plan, I've spent a lot of time on two areas that we'll come back to. I'm not going to get into all the details because we will talk about these specifics, but let me just say with respect to reforming universal service, I like a lot of what the plan has to say, and also with respect to the national purposes piece of the plan, there's a lot of good stuff in there that we need to talk about, but overall, adoption, I think is the key. I mentioned we're available, our service, to 92% of the country. There's some places the phone companies go or other alternative technologies go that we don't. So something less than 8% of the country doesn't have access to some kind of high-speed internet service today. So my own personal focus in a lot of my work recently has been on the adoption side, where it's been shown that perhaps a third of those to whom service is available choose not to take it. I think the plan gets a lot of that right. Again, we'll leave that for further, more in-depth discussion.
Yeah, we'll get into more specifics later, as you said. I want to turn to Barbara. What do you see as the keys for turning this into action?
Well, before we get to that, I just want to say that I agree with Michael and Rick that this is a very important plan just to have, the fact of its existence. And its focus on mobile broadband is very important, as is its focus on adoption. So I think those are, the FCC got it absolutely right in doing a comprehensive job and picking out some of the key areas to focus on. I'm going to talk a little bit about what the plan is, how it came about, because I think that this is an important detail. It is comprehensive and will move the ball forward just by raising consciousness about the role of the broadband internet. But, as they say, the devil is in the details, and this plan is extraordinarily detailed. But what you have to understand is that what was received by Congress is essentially a very comprehensive analytical FCC staff report. It was not adopted by a vote of the full commission, and some of the commissioners have already expressed concern or disagreement with some of its key proposals. not putting the plan to a vote of the commissioners allowed the staff to think outside of the box and come up with some really creative suggestions for broadband deployment and adoption. And the plan essentially says, this is what we would like to see happen. And that allowed it to go forward without a concern on the front burner about statutory constraints the FCC might have in implementing it. But the FCC's legal authority, of course, will be addressed in the rulemaking phase, and that's where I would think some attention needs to be turned. I've called the plan more like a jigsaw puzzle than an actual plan. It's a series of interlocking recommendations, some of which seem to fit together very well, and others seem standing on their own. The problem is, how do these mesh, and how will this affect the realization of the goals of the plan? Just one example, the source of funding for some of the recommendations for subsidies to extend broadband generally and to support a public safety broadband network specifically include both user fees and projected spectrum auction revenues, perhaps including those derived from the reclamation of 120 megahertz of spectrum currently licensed for broadcast television. But the plan is based on the voluntary return of that broadcast spectrum, which is unlikely to occur unless Congress approves compensation to the broadcasters returning their spectrum. This is a highly contentious issue, and whether it goes forward could affect the revenue neutrality of the plan as put forward. In other words, this plan could cost more than the FCC is projecting because it's based on a lot of assumptions about all the pieces falling into place. Do I have any more time now?
You have a few seconds to wrap up.
Okay. The real focus of what I prepared was on the FCC's jurisdiction, and I know we're going to get into that later, but suffice it to say that the FCC remains constrained in its authority by the Communications Act of 1934, and that is based on a series of service and technology-specific statutory authorizations from Congress that simply don't work anymore in the Internet age. And a big question is, for the pieces Congress has to implement, does it do so in a piecemeal fashion, making little tweaks to the statute, or should it do what I called an extreme makeover and really start over and reformulate the act? And I am in favor of the latter.
So on the issue of implementing the next steps, the plan itself, I think, is I would describe as being a mile wide and about 3 inches deep. So in other words, it looked under every rock possible and addressed just about every issue under the sun. But I would characterize it as not so much an action plan, but sort of a plan for an action plan. And unfortunately, I think it does ignore the issues that are glaring, which is problems with competition in our broadband market. It doesn't push on the analytics here. It identifies that there is a competition problem likely now, and that going forward in the future, if you define broadband as being something faster than about 10 megabits per second, that about 85% of the country will live under a cable monopoly. And it doesn't really talk about what to do about that. But most of what we can realistically expect to move on this, I think, falls on the shoulders of the FCC. There are some recommendations to the executive branch, other departments and agencies. There are 76, by my count, recommendations for Congress. And these range from the innocuous, like having Congress make sure all votes are online or allowing public comment on pending legislation, which essentially is code word for put up a blog and allow comments, right? Commercial recommendations range to the sensible, like Big Once legislation. We have some of that pending. To the monopoly, there's a recommendation in there for creating an endowment for public media. And I think that's a great idea, but this is something that Blue Ribbon panels have recommended in the past and haven't really acted on. But ultimately, like I say, most of what's going to happen that will actually happen will fall on the shoulders of the FCC. And even there, I think the plan was probably designed not to really rock the boat initially, but when they actually start implementing some of these ideas into rules, it will start rocking some boats, and that will require, I think, a tremendous amount of political courage on the part of particularly the chairman of the FCC, that I'm not sure that he'll be able to either muster, or even if he does, we'll be able to turn a lot of this into actual rules.
Thanks. Well, I just want to talk a little bit about the timing here, and anyone can feel free to weigh in on this. Chairman Jankowski has been quick to point out that the plan isn't self-executing. Keyword. In other words, it doesn't actually make any new rules in itself. It just is, you know, a series of proposals. So the FCC is set to, you know, open a series of proceedings in which they're going to seek public comment and, in some cases, propose new rules. So my question for panelists is, you know, how aggressive do you expect the rollout of these proceedings to be, and when are they going to start popping up?
I would expect the rollout to begin almost immediately, and we should start to see action on some items within the FCC's jurisdiction. And having said that, I would just say that the pace of a rulemaking proceeding is what I've always said. It's a bit like childbirth. They take about 9 months. Sometimes the baby comes earlier than expected, but as a rule of thumb, they require at least 6 to 9 months, unless you're moving extraordinarily quickly, which I think could only be done in some of the more non-controversial areas.
I definitely agree that we can't really say whether or not this commission, this chairman's commission, is one that's going to be very aggressive, because largely they haven't done a lot so far to give us any ideas. But having said that, I think they've shown they've been very good at asking questions, so I think probably starting this week, we'll see a schedule for what they call notices of proposed rulemaking or notices of inquiry, which are basically the agency's way of starting to implement rules. I do think there are some pending, what we call NPRMs, or proposed rules that have been pending for years that sort of fold into the plan's recommendations that could be rolled on quickly. All he has to do is get 3 votes, and they can move these things really quickly, have very truncated public comment periods, and move very quickly. But I do think on some of the more vexing questions like universal service, they're going to probably proceed at a very deliberate pace. And I really realistically don't see anything happening on that for 2 years at the earliest.
Derek, just very briefly, which are the issues that have been pending for a long time that could see quick action?
Well, one of the more, I think, important recommendations in the plan is recommendations to deal with so-called special access markets. So these are high-capacity lines, dedicated lines that businesses, cell phone companies, other smaller internet service providers use as inputs to provide their service. There is some dispute amongst the companies that own these, which are usually the big bell companies, Verizon, AT&T, and Quest, that the companies, at least from them, think that the rates are too high, and in some cases they think that the FCC prematurely deregulated this market. There's been a proceeding pending since 2005. The FCC has refreshed the record on a couple of different times, most recently last year, and I think, though they didn't show their hand in the National Broadband Plan, I do think staff in the Wireline Bureau have an idea of what to do here, and I think they could probably move that pretty quickly.
So, first on you know, long pending dockets for anyone that files comments at the FCC, they know that any filing which dealing with universal service, you start out with docket number 9645. So that means that it was a docket that it was opened in 1996, and you know there's been 17 orders on reconsideration, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the most pressing issues aren't necessarily pending since 1996, but in general, it's been an open proceeding for 14 years with various aspects. So, but having said that, as a general matter, I think the commission will move fairly aggressively. I don't look to the last year as Derek does and say they haven't been very aggressive. I think that clearly the staff, anyway, spent lots and lots of time on the broadband plan. They spent $20 million. I don't think the chairman is going to allow that $20 million expenditure to, you know, to just be a blip and nothing come to show besides this 367-page document. I mean, I think they've got a plan, and I think it's going to be similar to post-96 Telecom Act, where, on the one hand, they did have statutory deadlines for a number of proceedings, but on the other hand, the chairman was at the commission at that time with Chairman Hunt, And I think along those lines, we're going to see a list of proceedings, a timeline, and an aggressive effort to complete as many of them as possible in the next several years. So I expect them to be fairly aggressive.
Well, yeah, just second at it, I think they will be aggressive, and we've heard that a schedule is expected, you know, this week. So at some point this week, a schedule with a roadmap of sorts could be up to probably up to as many as 40 proceedings. They won't all, I hope they won't all open them simultaneously, but probably would come out in waves over the next 12 months. But, you know, the chairman's chief of staff and others, you know, have mentioned to expect in the first wave universal service reform, because the plan itself calls for a three-stage process, and so they have to really get that going. So that should be quickly up. Special access, as Derek mentioned, so that there's more kind of wholesale access to backhaul for more, you know, for some of the competitive carriers. Also, spectrum. They may not jump immediately into the TV band issue, which is the most contentious, but probably they can move ahead with some of the auctions that they outlined. And then there's this this notion of a gateway device of requiring an interoperability standard among video programming providers, such as cable set-top boxes and so on. I'm not sure why that's such a priority, but it seems to be, so it's talked about as a, as in this first wave.
Okay. Well, not as Bill mentioned, some of these proceedings have been open for years, and the rulemaking process can take 9 months. Does having a plan speed up any of this? Does it make it more of a priority, or can we expect the usual time frame the FCC has historically taken?
Well, I think to some degree the preparation of the plan halted all forward progress on many of these long pending dockets. So we've already paid a bit of a price in terms of time and attention at the commission. When you call something related to broadband and say that is your top priority, it means that thing is going to go more slowly than it would have normally. It's just a fact of administrative life. However, since the chairman has very clearly made increased broadband deployment and adoption the focal point of his chairmanship of the commission, I would expect that they would try to make the move more quickly. I think I'm a little concerned that might not happen.
I do agree that the plan itself sort of stops some common sense things that were probably would have moved otherwise. For example, before this administration came in, the FCC had some pending recommendations about broadband data that the plan did confirm are good ideas. But when we were waiting for Chairman Jenikowski to be seated by Congress, those recommendations sat idle. And then when he got in, he didn't want to do anything because he wanted to wait and see what the broadband plan team came up with. So hopefully that'll be one of the early things to move. But I do think some of the things they really want to move, they probably are going to move fast because we have the issue of one of the Democratic commissioners, Chairman Cox. His term expires this summer, and he'll be basically allowed to serve through the end of the year. And then at that point, unless we get another commissioner seated quickly, we'll have a 2-2 commission, which is a recipe for either compromise or a recipe for gridlock. And so I think if they want to be aggressive about moving some of these things, they're probably going to try to do it before the end of the year.
But so I don't want to get into the finer points of administrative law, partly because I'm not a lawyer. But I think we should distinguish between the pending dockets and new dockets. Certainly with respect to any new proposed rulemakings, there is a limit on how fast they can proceed. Typically it would be a 30-day comment cycle, maybe a 30-day reply comment cycle. So there are certain benchmarks that, they have to undertake, and then formulate their response to those comments and, you know, figure out the rules. So that's why, as Barbara said, and, you know, we should, you know, we didn't get into the bios, nor should we have, but Barbara was at the FCC, and I think during the 96 Act, the all of the proceedings that flowed from it,
before
and after. So, you know, so it has a lot of experience here. So they can only move so fast. On pending dockets, however, unless there's a need to refresh the record, you know, there could be a decision this afternoon on one of these things, and nothing really holding them back. But I do want to say one other thing about the plan. Even though it did sort of halt work on a lot of proceedings, I think one way in which it is useful is that, at least to the extent that any docket or proceeding touches on broadband, it contextualizes everything, if you will. Now, again, this was a staff plan, and, you know, and the chairman put it out and not the other commissioners, but in a sense, it kind of gives a global or holistic view of how a lot of things fit together that may have been lacking in the past on some of these proceedings, because many of these, you know, intercarrier compensation is very closely related to universal service, which is, you know, potentially related to the special access issues and all of these things that, that at least with one worldview, if not everyone's worldview, may allow them to move more quickly.
Okay, thanks. Well, I know there are a number of congressional staff in the audience, so I want to talk about, you know, what kind of legislation is required to enact this plan, and, you know, thinking especially in the near term, and, you know, how soon can we expect Congress to produce the legislation that's needed? And just another thing I want to put in there is, you know, we have the elections coming up in November, so what kind of effect will that have on their schedule?
Well, you know, Robert and I were actually talking about this earlier. It's rather unfortunate that the plan didn't sort of have a separate appendix on here are the recommendations for Congress, here are the recommendations for other agencies. But if you keyword search on Congress should or Congress could, you'll come up across the literally 76 of them. And I actually think that if you're looking for something for your boss to have a good bill that actually has a chance of moving, there's a lot of very non-controversial things in here that touch on a whole wide array of areas in different parts of market that the federal government may have involvement in. So, you know, I don't see any reason why those wouldn't move other than just the constraints of you know, recess coming up, you know, for the summer and everyone going home and campaigning. But, you know, I'm not a complete cynic, but I don't really have a lot of faith that some of the bigger ticket items in here, such as Congress actually stepping in and weighing in on the issue of reallocation of broadcast spectrum. It's probably an election year. It's probably not a good idea to go to take away spectrum from the venues that you're going to be running your campaign ads on. So some of those bigger ticket items that actually require either the spending of a lot of federal money, which there are a few of in here, or upsetting, you know, some very powerful players like the broadcasters, I don't really view that as realistic, but, you know, I've seen stranger things.
Well, we should parse your question a little bit, Adam, because you said what kind of legislation is required or, you know, needed. And I don't think that any legislation is necessarily required or needed for the FCC to, you know, to get moving and do some of these things, with the possible exception of, you know, on the public safety side. I think there's been a, you know, a groundswell, if that's the right word, and that's not my area of expertise, so I don't want to get too into it, except to point out that, you know, certainly it's not going to happen without Congress. Having said that, there are some things that maybe Congress should do. I mean, you know, we have expressed support for several bills that actually were introduced prior to the plan but are related. For example, Congresswoman Matsui's bill on extending broadband to or extending Lifeline to broadband. Lifeline is a program that allows for discounted telephone service for low-income citizens and or low-income residents, I should say. And similarly, there are several E-rate bills. E-rate, of course, the subsidy program for schools and libraries to get online. All of those are related in some sense to the broadband plan. Just one other thing that Derek mentioned with respect to the national purposes piece, there are a number of easy things, for example, on telework. changing the, maybe it's not easy when I think about it, because it says change the tax treatment. So changing tax is not easy, but I guess I would call them common sense things, things that folks have talked about for years, that, you know, as we all that were here for the various snowstorms this year, that were able to telework from home or from home or wanted to telework from home, there are various government restrictions to doing that that could be cleared away. In some cases, that may just be an executive branch decision, but I think when probably what, you know, someone here ought to do is go through and get the, you know, the top 10, like, easy things to do and say, you know, let's get this done by the end of the summer or something. We can all agree on this.
There's one area where the commission says that it needs authority. Somebody alluded to this, which was to have expanded auction authority for incentive auctions. In other words, that where they would use auction revenue or public money to pay incumbents to get off their ban. So the TV ban in particular, there's a recommendation to go back and have another DTV transition, repurpose 20 more channels, and they're saying they need authority for an incentive auction, in other words, to pay the broadcasters to do that, which has been controversial in the past. We can talk more about that later. But they actually don't, though, and what's interesting is I think the FCC would, in general, like that authority to use in a variety of circumstances. They don't really need that authority for the TV ban because there are types of auctions you can have, and they've done it in the past, where the winners can negotiate with the incumbents to move them off the ban. It just may not be quite as neat and efficient. On the other hand, there's an area I mentioned earlier where they should have been more explicit in asking for congressional action, and that is, you know, they say, they're very articulate in saying how important it is to provide a gigabit level of connectivity to all the community anchor institutions, the public schools, libraries, hospitals, and public safety agencies in every kind of hamlet, but then there's not a word about where the money would come from for that. The BTOP program, in other words, under the stimulus, the Commerce Department has been shifting its priority in the grant giving more towards the community anchors, but there's not nearly enough money there to do the job.
And now there are also some recommendations for other federal agencies, states, local governments. What's in there on that, and what's the time frame for those other parts of government?
Well, Derek pointed to the 76 congressional recommendations, and I should have had these enumerated, but let me just say that on this list that was prepared by a law firm that I have, let's see, there's 3.5 pages for Congress of all the recommendations they've listed, and I've got 9 pages for other agencies. So there's a lot of stuff in there for other agencies, ranging, and most of it, not all of it, comes out of the national purposes piece. But basically, how can barriers to adoption be reduced? And by barriers, they're talking about relevance in particular. One of the off-sided reasons why people don't subscribe is, it's hard to believe for most of us in the room probably, but for a lot of people, I think the statistic is something like 19% of folks polled in a recent FCC survey done by a gentleman from the Pew Internet Research Center who did similar studies. 19% said reason they don't subscribe is they don't find broadband relevant to their lives. So one of the ways that broadband can be made more relevant is whether government services are delivered through broadband or more available through broadband. Certainly, you know, one of the greatest boons for many of us is the fact that you don't ever, almost never, have to go to the DMV anymore. You can do most of it online if you're a broadband subscriber. So they've got a list of recommendations on healthcare, dealing with health records, access to health records, the privacy issues. There are a number of issues, cross-state licensing of physicians, Medicare reimbursement for home health care and monitoring. Similarly, with respect to education, with respect to what they term civic engagement, any number of recommendations for other agencies. Whether any of them will happen, I don't know. That my own, you know, personal recommendation that I have made in other forums like this would be that that they should have perhaps recommended that the CTO, who, you know, otherwise doesn't have authority over any of these agencies, that I think a great role for the CTO would be sort of shepherding some of these recommendations through these agencies.
Well, could there be resistance on their part to actually adopting any of the proposals?
There could.
That's why I brought up the fact that this is a staff report with a lot of recommendations and not an action adopted by the full commission. I think there is a question raised by the manner in which the plan came out as to whether the other agencies that would have to implement many of these recommendations are going to feel the same weight of authority behind the plan. And that's just a question. I don't know. I read somewhere that the SCC said they were working very well with these other agencies, and that's good to hear. You want government bodies working collaboratively. But in some instances, the plan pretty much tells these other agencies, like Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, for example, how to approach utility rates. And it's an open question whether FERC will feel compelled to follow the plan of the staff of the commission.
I think it depends to some extent on the agency and their role. So just one area that we were involved in has to do with an adoption program that is related to HUD. And I know that the adoption staff, if you will, for the broadband plan engaged in extensive discussions with HUD on how they might move the needle for low income. By definition, all HUD residents are low income, but with HUD households. And actually, if I can, let me just say, take a minute to talk about that program. But the larger point is they had extensive discussions with HUD, and HUD is an agency that wants more broadband for their constituents. So, you know, FERC, they regulate utilities in various ways. You know, whether they look at these recommendations as useful or helpful, who knows? But HUD, I think, does because they have, as part of their mission, trying to improve the lives of their residents, and more broadband is the way to do it. So let me, this is my commercial or plug or whatever, but we joined, 13 cable companies that make up, covering 85% of the country, as well as AT&T, Intel, Dell, Microsoft, One Economy, and Connected Nation, jointly working together on a program for which One Economy has applied for BTOP funding from NTIA, about $50 million, I'm not sure the exact number. The idea would be that HUD residents would be able to get a discounted device, a computer of some sort. They would get digital literacy training, and they would get discounted broadband service, free installation, discounted or free modem or hardware. The idea is, and we haven't gotten too much into adoption, but I referenced the earlier adoption study that the FCC did, and it showed that barriers to adoption are a multifaceted issue for its affordability, its relevance, its lack of a device. This is a program that tries to target all of those pieces, and for 250,000 households, if this application is funded, all of us would be joining together to make this happen. The final one important point for this, we and AT&T, the cable industry and AT&T, the ISPs or the broadband providers, are not seeking any subsidy here. The dollars would flow to the device subsidy as well as the digital literacy and training piece.
Okay. Well, I want to get into some of the specific issues. There's been some talk already about the Universal Service Fund, which for people who don't know is basically the government subsidy program. It gives money to fund telephone service in high-cost areas. also money goes to low-income households and a variety of other underserved people. And the FCC, what they want to do is change the fund to focus on broadband. So I guess my question for the panelists, first of all, just the timing issue again. I mean, the FCC and Congress have been trying to overhaul this for years. Congressman Boucher has had legislation several years running now. He's about to put out, introduce a new version. You know, I guess, why hasn't it happened already? What are the odds that it's going to happen? And who's going to do it this time, you know, FCC or Congress?
Well, to answer why it hasn't happened, the existing structure, at least the high-cost portion of the Universal Service Fund, or the fund that pays for telephone service in rural areas, it's bound by the statute, it's bound by the law, which basically says that in order for a service to be funded, it has to be subscribed to by a substantial majority of consumers. And so, believe it or not, it wasn't until about 2006 that we crossed the 50% adoption threshold, and it really made people start to feel comfortable that, yes, this is a substantial majority of consumers subscribe to this. So the joint board, who is state regulators and federal regulators together, they recommended to the FCC in 2007 a sort of way of adding broadband onto the fund, and the FCC opened up for comments from everyone to ask how to implement that. Largely, they got a lot of criticism that it essentially just, you know, didn't really transform a fund or transition the fund. It just ballooned the size of the fund by adding another service on top of it. So Chairman Martin, at the end of his tenure, actually had a reasonable but not too radical plan to sort of transition the fund to be a broadband fund. And in addition to that, to also provide subsidies for low-income households to buy broadband services. And I wouldn't view it as being too controversial. He did try to get some industry buy-in, but in the end of the day, he had one vote for it, and that was his vote. So the plan that they propose now isn't that dissimilar from what he proposed. So though everyone said great and nice things about it to begin with, I think it doesn't address some of the underlying issues. Like Rick's organization identified the fact that in many of these areas where the phone company receives subsidies, there's already a cable company that's deployed services that's completely unsubsidized and can offer telephone service, can offer internet service and video services at the same level that the telephone company's offering if you take away their subsidy. And the cost probably won't go up. So the plan didn't really address the need for universal service subsidies, and I think that's one of the big failures of this, is that we haven't actually looked at where we can spend the money to have the outcome we desire most efficiently. But that'll all be debated here in the next couple of months, and I honestly think, you know, we'll hear a lot of the same old arguments, but I would hope that this FCC would actually to look at this problem in a way that hasn't been looked at by anyone else before.
Does anyone think that there could be a conflict between what the FCC is trying to do in their plan and, you know, what's happening in Congress right now in terms of who actually takes the lead on this?
Chairman Boucher's bill has been floating around, and he obviously thinks that they should probably, Congress should be taking the lead here, and that's probably correct. If we want to get this to a point where it's well understood that Congress endorses this scheme, then it might be best for Congress to have a law. But I think Chairman Boucher's bill doesn't really go far enough to really transform the fund or actually making the fund more efficient. And FCC does have the authority now to do some things to this, but as Barbara mentioned earlier, some of their jurisdictional questions may mean that at the end of the day, they can only end up funding the least efficient DSL carrier and not funding a new wireless entry because the law bounds them to do that.
I'm in complete agreement with Derek on many of the points, and I think he's raised something that's very important and people ought to think about. Universal service support means that revenues derived from the provision of telephone services go to support the provision of telephone services to other subscribers and to support high-cost companies. This is an unusual way to fund something, and if you read the broadband plan, it said the broadband internet is now, you could say, critical infrastructure supporting many aspects of our society and economy. So the question is, do you need to continue and want to continue supporting this platform from users of the service, or should it be supported through general revenues derived from taxes in this country? And there are a lot of good arguments why the system would work better if you ceased having something like a universal service support fund and provided targeted subsidies to individuals who can't afford to buy broadband but want it, or companies whose costs are extraordinarily high.
So, I'm somewhat of a neophyte when it comes to universal service because I've only been working on it for 20 years, since 1990 when I first started at the Florida Public Service Commission and was working on universal service down there. I think the two choices, if there is to be reform at all, are, incremental reform or radical reform. And obviously, radical reform is more difficult. So I agree with both Barbara and Derek, but I just, having seen how things have gone over the last many years, I don't know how radical reform will take place. However, having said that, I'm not as down on what the FCC is recommending as it sounded like Derek is. I give them credit if not for not going far enough. They're doing a couple of things that I think have not been done before. And one of them is, and Derek referenced this, we offered up a petition earlier in the year, or actually late last year, suggesting that there ought to be a fresh look at high-cost universal service subsidies where there is an unsubsidized competitor. It was a very rational approach that said, hey, we're out there providing competition without anyone giving us money. We're providing all the same services. Why should they be getting money in this particular place? That was one. So let's use those savings to potentially redirect or refocus and move those subsidies to broadband in some way. So although not explicitly endorsing our petition, the fact that they are, one, recognizing that competition needs to be taken into account. You know, they haven't made any major structural changes since the 96 Act with respect to universal service, and yet we're offering unsubsidized voice service to 82% or better of the country today. Two, they say, when we look, let's take all revenues into account. Under the system today, it's really a cost-based system, and where an incumbent phone company has a cost that's a certain percentage higher than the national average, they receive subsidies. But they're only there's no revenue part of the equation. But through that singular plant that they have, they're getting revenues often from broadband service, from video service, as well as phone service. And it doesn't make sense that they're only looking at the cost side of the equation without looking at the revenue equation. There's some other good stuff in there, too, but my point is just that they are, at least the staff, is recognizing some things that I think have not been recognized in previous efforts at universal service.
So, jumping real quick, I really get the impression that I'm completely disappointed in the USF section. I think if implemented the way it's outlined, it'll be a tremendous improvement over the current system. But little things like, so what Rick was just talking about, right now, if you're a rural carrier, you basically get a guaranteed rate of return. And the way the system works is they submit what all their costs are, and they show what all their regulated revenues are and the subsidies based on that. It ignores the fact that they may have data revenues, that they may have television revenues offered over the same infrastructure. Going forward, the normal fund that will fund broadband build out in areas where it's not available now takes into consideration all costs and all revenues. But they didn't do anything to the existing fund where broadband may actually be currently deployed. These companies may be offering triple play services, and if you look at all the revenues, they don't need an ongoing subsidy to maintain support, but yet they'll still get it. So those are the kind of things that I'm a little bit concerned about that haven't been really confronted.
Okay, well, we can probably talk more about this in Q&A. I just want to move to wireless a little bit and get Michael back in the conversation here.
And take me out.
I'll have a great, yes. So on wireless, the FCC set a goal to find 500 megahertz of spectrum by 2020, and 300 megahertz would be made available in 3 years. I just want to ask briefly, what needs to happen to achieve that, and is that enough spectrum to, meet the exploding demand for wireless?
Okay. So that's, I didn't even want to trample in here with our USF experts at the table, but on spectrum, we definitely you know, I think it was deservedly a very big emphasis of the broadband plan to free up a lot more spectrum access and to do it in various ways. The wireless industry has been asking for 800 more megahertz that would be auctioned for exclusive licensing. So in other words, spectrum that would fit their current business model. The plan, as you said, appears, I think some people interpreted it on its face as saying, okay, well, you want 800, we're going to give you 500 over 10 years and 300 more quickly within 5 years. But actually, that interpretation is misleading in a few different ways. First, the goal of 500 megahertz in the plan, we should be clear, includes both licensed and unlicensed spectrum, so both exclusively licensed and shared. So it's not a promise to make that much auction that much more spectrum for exclusive licensing, which actually would be fairly unrealistic. And that's reflected in the fact that the FCC, if you look at the 300 megahertz that they're saying they can hopefully free up within 5 years, two-thirds of that is either not flexibly, is not new flexibly licensed, or it's extremely politically difficult. So, for example, 90 megahertz of the 390 is mobile satellite spectrum, where what they're saying is they're not saying take it from the incumbents who aren't using it and have an auction. What they're saying is we're going to give the satellite companies more flexibility so that they can have maybe a more robust terrestrial component to what they're doing now, that maybe satellite can become a little more of a player in the broadband game. So that won't be spectrum that I don't believe that the Verizons or the AT&Ts of the world or Sprint or T-Mobile will be using. And then another 120 megahertz are the 20 television channels that would have to be taken away from the broadcasters. And as Derek said, that may be a political bridge too far. There's all sorts of complications to that, which we can talk about a little more. On the positive side, though, I think this is better news that the plan actually only identifies non-governmental spectrum specifically. And it sort of passes the ball to NTIA, to the Commerce Department, concerning governmental spectrum that could be freed up. And that's really where most of the spectrum is that should be available, because the federal government is sitting on the greatest amount of underutilized spectrum. Now, the problem there is the military and others say they can't give it up completely what they have, because if they need the fighter jets suddenly to swoop in, and it may be only once every 6 months or who knows when, but then they really need it when they need it. And so for that reason, it was very promising in the plan to see not only a recommendation that and I think probably the White House will back this up, that NTIA and FCC together recommend bands that can be either reallocated by auction or shared, and the spectrum inventory bills that are pending and about to pass, at least the House bill requires that as well, that kind of recommendation. But the federal agencies, including the military, are increasingly saying, that they could indeed share fairly large amounts of spectrum using new, smart radio technologies. So I think we'll find that there's, a lot more potential to free up spectrum on the federal side, in particular by sharing. And they also call for proceeding in the plan to expand on the TV white space database concept to allow bands to be listed with certain conditions for sharing. And that's very promising, too.
But you mentioned the legislation in the House and the Senate on a spectrum inventory. How does that legislation factor into the FCC's plan with regard to finding the spectrum, or doesn't it at all?
Just to try to answer that quick, others can chime in, but the plan anticipates those bills passing. Mm-hmm. In fact, even to the degree that on the day the plan was released, the commission previewed a spectrum dashboard, a kind of a public interface, so that you could go in and you know, find and look at a certain band and see who has it licensed and so on. It'll take that legislation, I think, for the federal bands to be added in any detail to that sort of dashboard. But we
here is new to say what the bills are directing.
So the bills, they're extremely bipartisan. So, you know, I've heard that, in fact, on the Senate side, it may be, you know, the Radio Spectrum Inventory Act, I think it's called on both sides, you know, may be close to unanimous consent in the Senate and you know, really in good stead on the House side as well. It requires the FCC and the NTIA to do an inventory of the spectrum with an emphasis, with a priority on the spectrum that's most suitable for wireless broadband from about 300, the ranges differ, but from roughly 300 megahertz up to 3.7 gigahertz. The House bill goes further in a couple important respects. They say they should do up to 10 gigahertz if they have the resources. They have to come back and explain why they don't go up to 10 gigahertz if they can. And probably more importantly, it directs that they must, the agencies together, FCC and TIA, must come back with recommendations as to what specific bands can be cleared for auction or open for more sharing. And in fact, that's where most of our unlicensed spectrum use is today, is on bands that are shared with military radar. The downside is that sharing to date has been completely passive. In other words, the military says, as long as we don't notice you, we don't have to do anything, you know, yeah, good luck. But in fact, there are ways, including the another bill that's pending by Congressman Inslee, where you could expand the ability of federal agencies to share underutilized bands more robustly. Okay.
Well, we're going to go to Q&A in just a few minutes, but I wanted to have to talk about what's happening in the D.C. Circuit, where Comcast is, you know, challenging the FCC's claim that it has legal authority to regulate the Internet, and this could have, you know, so a lot of implications. Barbara, if you could just explain briefly what this jurisdictional issue is all about. I think
well, before I do that, I'll put forth I don't know if it's a disclaimer. Along with two law professors, I filed an amicus brief in the appeal before the D.C. Circuit. And, of course, Derek's group is also involved in the decision, so you can take whatever we have to say with a grain of salt. I call it LaFerre BitTorrent at this point, but I think probably everyone in the world knows about this. But the FCC had a set of four policy principles, which are generally net neutrality principles. They enforced them against a single operator in 2008, Comcast. Comcast appealed that enforcement action and said, you can't enforce principles, you can only enforce rules, and by the way, you don't have jurisdiction to enforce these principles under the Communications Act because it doesn't allow you to regulate the provision of Internet services. This is definitely the nutshell guide to the case. So the case went up to the D.C. Circuit, and oral argument was held this winter, and most people agree it didn't go so good for the FCC. The oral argument concluded with a panel asking the FCC's counsel, would you like to lose narrowly or broadly? Of course, he said, I'd prefer to lose narrowly. We'd like some guidance, and the court said, we decide cases, we don't give guidance. But the universal opinion coming out of the oral argument is that the FCC will lose. So it does depend whether the FCC loses narrowly or broadly. If it loses narrowly, the court agrees you can enforce a policy statement. You can only enforce rules, have a rulemaking, which of course there is one pending. The court decides the case broadly, it might conclude that the FCC's legal theory that it has jurisdiction to regulate the provision of Internet services under its ancillary jurisdiction is wrong. Now, ancillary jurisdiction is, it's kind of like the equivalent of a legal fiction. It's implied jurisdiction. It is not expressly granted by Congress. The argument is that it's implicit in the regulatory authority Congress explicitly gave the agency that it can cover areas not explicitly mentioned. The problem for the net neutrality or open internet rulemaking is that the FCC put out its notice of proposed rulemaking using the identical legal theory that is currently before the DC Circuit in the Comcast decision. So if it loses broadly, the stated legal basis of the rules proposed in the open internet proceeding would not be available to it. Then the question becomes, is there another theory or way in which the FCC could adopt those same rules under the Act today, or must it seek an amendment of the Act by Congress?
Okay. Wow, we could have an entire panel on what you just laid out there.
But put it at the end.
I don't want to filibuster and take a lot of time, but I do think that it is sort of an existential question for the Commission at this point. I personally think that Congress in 1996 clearly saw the converged world coming, and it clearly understood that there's a difference between a company that provides services over the internet, not on its own facilities, and a company that is a facilities-based provider, and that it clearly intended for the FCC to have jurisdiction over communication by wire or wireless. And what the FCC did in 2003 and 2005, I think, was essentially an extra legal way around the law. And it's essentially, if Congress got a way for the FCC to deregulate telecommunications companies, and that was through the process of forbearance, and the Commission sort of took a different approach to that by classifying broadband internet access services as pure information services. And that's what is really at stake here. Depending on how the Comcast case comes down, if the court, you know, rules more broadly, as Barbara said, it could undermine things in this plan, such as, you know, the universal service stuff, the truth in billing, disclosure, consumer privacy, disability issues, wireless data roaming. There's a whole host of issues that the Commission will likely, in the coming interim, will stand up on ancillary jurisdiction to something in Title II or Title III of the Act. But if this whole notion of how they tried to stand up things in the past based on this ancillary authority is unraveled, they could end up putting forward rules and getting sued. I mean, companies like Verizon said in 2006 they didn't believe the FCC had the authority to do universal service for broadband. So if they end up getting sued, this entire plan could be unraveled in a matter of years, and I hope that this chairman doesn't want that to be his legacy. And so we are asking them, and we certainly hope that when they release the schedule of notices this coming week, that part of that is them just asking the question, should we reclassify broadband internet access services, or at least the wires that provide that, as a telecommunication service with an information service component, and sort of undo some of the things that were done during the last commission.
So it's important to make a couple of points. First of all, I think an FCC watcher will tell you that they get sued over every single case, so they shouldn't back away just because they think they're going to get sued. What they should do, though, is try to, you know, have the most robust and legal rationale for doing what they do, but they shouldn't shy away because they think they're going to get sued. I have a different take on ancillary authority, and specifically with respect to universal service. Our CEO filed a letter demonstrating at least one way that the FCC could reach broadband universal service through Section 254, as they do today in E-rate, not because of ancillary authority, but because of the specific language of the statute. It allowed extending information services, internet access, to schools and libraries, and also non-telecommunications providers, specifically cable companies and others, to be reimbursed for the discount they provide, even at the same time as some people are arguing, oh no, Section 254, telecommunications companies, et cetera. So I think universal service is sort of a stalking horse for the Title II classification question. But maybe the most important point I can make, and I share the pain of my telephone company brethren and don't want them to be treated differently than us, but it's very important when we look at the history here, and this is almost always lost in these discussions, cable companies were never treated as Title II services for the provision of broadband, not from the 96 Act. If we go back to the history of open access, the Portland case, the Ninth Circuit. We walked in, we the cable industry, actually PCI, the company, and then AT&T, in the city of Portland, thinking, wow, when cable companies offer broadband service, it's a cable service. That's what we thought, and one of the big issues was, can they impose these open access requirements, and by the way, you know, can they charge the requisite fees? And that's what we thought, and the court came back and said, well, you know what, even though no one suggested this in the case or briefed it or anything else, we think it's a telecom service. And the Ninth Circuit agreed that it was a telecom service, and we went to the Supreme Court. The FCC ruled, no, it's an information service, went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court agreed with the FCC that it is, in fact, an information service. But the biggest point there that I want to make and stress is we have never been treated as Title II carriers for the provision of broadband, and even with the, you know, the parsing or the, what I'll say, the, you know, the corrections of some statements that have been made in the past about how broadband providers were treated, and the focus on broadband transmission service, cable companies' broadband transmission service has never been something that we offer as a standalone service, and has therefore not been regulated as a Title II service.
I mean, companies like Time Warner have standalone Title II tariffs, special access services. So, I mean, that's glossing over what the reality is. And cable companies, recognize exactly where a lot of them got in the business of CLEC. So they did enter into becoming
a broadband service has never been treated. Let's distinguish central access service. You know, when we make data services available, yes. But the kind of thing that we're talking about that everyone is saying needs to be classified as Title II so we can oppose net neutrality or do all of these other things has never been treated as Title II.
Okay. So, well, I have a bunch of questions, but because we just have 10 minutes left, but we can probably pick up on this a little bit.
All right, yeah, go ahead.
There was more to it than that. It did start out that way. We became two-way, but, for example, there is language in the Act that to the extent we provide a cable service, we can't be treated as a common carrier in the provision of that service. Right. Well, on the cable service. But, again, we not video. Cable service, not necessarily video. Cable service. Yeah, I may refer to my attorney here as the statutory expert, but it doesn't say cable video. It says any cable service. But then there was language added in the 96 Act which allowed for some interactivity and, in effect, a two-way service. And, you know, I don't know the specific language, but we started out that way. Congress said in the statute, can't be treated as common carrier for the provision of a cable service. And again, we all thought, even Portland, you know, they thought, they went in, it's a cable service because it was the city and, you know, they had some regulatory authority over cable service and said, let's regulate it in, you know, this particular way. And ultimately, we got to the point where we are now, where it's been declared an information service.
Because you can offer, you know, two-way telephone service over a cable wire as well, and it shouldn't be treated different than the telephone companies providing the exact same service. And that's exactly what the FCC was doing in 2003 and 2004. They just decided to go the regulatory direction on the one hand, and to make it a level playing field between telephone and cable on the other by saying, oh, it's all information service, even though it's an end-to-end two-way service. But it's important to note that the Supreme Court in this decision, Brand X, that Rick mentions, essentially said it was the FCC's discretion, that it could have, it could regulate it as the transmission component of a two-way service, as a Title II service, a telecom service, or an information service. So it simply upheld the discretion of the expert agency. So now what the FCC faces is, as Derek said, this existential question of whether to go back and sort of undo the original sin, of the previous administration and say that, well, we're going to reclassify just the transmission component of broadband as Title II, and we're going to forbear from rate regulation and all the other kinds of traditional, you know, heavy-handed stuff. Or they can fight this out after every proceeding, whoever is the aggrieved carrier. So, for example, some of the rural phone companies and so on in USF, somebody's going to take them to court every time and battle out whether, in fact, they had sufficient ancillary jurisdiction, which is a real weak leg to stand on for things including universal service, transparency, consumer protection, prioritizing emergency services, and actually a whole lot of things in the plan.
Okay, are there any other questions? Yes, sir.
That's what I opened with. I don't see there's any way out of it. In fact, in 1996, right after the Telecom Act was passed, I started working on a memo. I was then in the Cable Services Bureau. The question was, under the 96 Act, could cable internet service be classified as fill-in-the-blank, cable service, telecom service, or whatever? At the time, I read the addition of two words, or use, to the definition of cable service as comprehending interactivity and a two-way service. And my theory was, yes, the FCC could conclude this is a cable service, but just would it want to? In other words, what are the pros and cons of doing so? And at the conclusion of my memo turned into an OPP working paper, I said that the definitions in the Act are going to collapse of their own weight because some of them go back to 1934, some were added in 1984, and they just won't get you where you need to go today. That was 1998. It's 2010. I don't think we've made much progress, but I think everyone is now painfully aware of the fact that you really need to do a comprehensive look at the Communications Act of 1934 and bring it into the digital age.
So is there interest in doing that that you can add to?
I mean, this has been a topic of discussion amongst this field for a long time, and that, you know, even during the debate around the COPE Act and the Senate bill in 2006, there was some discussion of doing this, though they largely didn't really address it then either. But frankly, I think that, yes, this is probably an issue that Congress needs to address. Yes, it'll be a multi-year process, like at least 2, 3, 4 years, maybe even longer for something like this to actually move. But I don't think the Commission has the luxury of standing by and waiting for Congress to deal with this now. If they want to make the stuff in this bill or in this plan into action, they're going to have to clarify their authority now. They either do it and by answer authority and they go to court 50 different times, or they reclassify, and I think there's a good, strong basis to do that based on the decisions and the justifications they made in 2005 to do that, and they go to court, to the Supreme Court in one big case, and we get to see whether or not that stands up. But they're going to court no matter what, and I think Congress largely did provide a very clear framework for what is a telecommunication service, what's an information service, what's a cable service. In the 96 rewrite of the Act, and it may not be perfect, but I certainly think it's workable now. And I certainly hope the FCC plows ahead and does what it needs to do to ensure that consumers are protected in the broadband age.
So three quick points, maybe four, just on that last point. I'm not sure that, I am sure that the Commission does not need to reclassify as a Title II service in order to protect consumers. I think there are many weapons, so to speak, at their disposal, and we shouldn't forget the role of the FTC as well. I would commend to all of you a letter that was jointly submitted by NCTA, Verizon, AT&T, and others specifically on the question of Title II and the Commission's legal authority and the likely outcome. I would add that Commissioner McDowell, for one, has insisted repeatedly that the Commission would be overturned should they try to do this for any number of reasons. But this 11-page letter is available on the web, or I'm happy to send it to any of you well worth looking at. But the last point that I wanted to make also is not to gloss over Barbara's paper. I mean, you know, the FCC does, they do working papers, whatever, you know, and some of them never see the light of day, or if they do, no one looks at them. But I think that both Barbara's paper and a paper a few years later called The Unregulation of the Internet by Jason Oxman are totally, you know, for me, the non-attorney in particular, the, you know, sort of seminal internet regulation or cable-related papers that even now, 12 years later, is really worth going back and looking at them. I assume it's on the FCC website or, you know, or PFF, or maybe Barbara has a personal website that...
It's on both the FCC and via the PFF website under my name, I believe.
But it really is worth looking at.
Can I just say, so if you do go and look at the letter that the NCTA and the other trade associations and the carriers wrote on this issue, we have our own rebuttal letter. I think this letter is a stunning example of hubris. It's got a lot of red bagging in it. It's full of things that are plainly not true. And I think it was a really sad event to see the tone change like that before the commission. So I invite you to come look at our letter that tries to take on some of the things they said that are plainly inaccurate.
Well, I think that our next Internet Caucus event should just be on Title I, Title II.
All right. Well, last question.
That's absolutely true, though. It doesn't mean that we probably shouldn't try. I think there are some things we can probably pull out that have more of a chance of going somewhere than obviously some of these other more controversial things.
Well, thanks so much for everyone coming and to our panelists.